Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Brett Morgan, filmmaker of the Chicago 10 film, which is opening at the Center for Contemporary Arts tomorrow. And tried that yesterday and had technical difficulties, but today we are confident that that's going to work. Right now, I'd like to welcome Bernadine Santisteban. She is the director, producer, and co-writer of the film The Cry, which opens on Friday, tomorrow, also at the Santa Fe Film Center on St. Michael's Drive in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you have made this film, which is, I guess you call it a modern-day thriller, based on the legend of La Llorona. First of all, tell us the story. Probably some people in New Mexico don't know the story of La Llorona.
Well, she was it was a story that was always told to me as a kid growing up, basically a story of a woman who had drowned her kids in the river, and as a result, she was condemned to roam the river forever, crying for her children. Always crying out, "Ay, mis hijos." In any event, our parents and our grandparents would tell us these stories of her and tell us if we went to the river to play alone, she would take us away, or if we misbehaved, she was going to take us. So she was sort of, she was a very frightening figure in many ways. And that's how I knew of her growing up. And, you know, most people hear similar stories.
So it's really a legend that parents and grandparents use to scare their kids?
Yeah, exactly. That's often what it's used as. When I started doing my research on the legend, though, I saw that there are far more complexities to it than what we hear growing up as children. Because first of all, you know, everyone seems to believe that La Llorona comes from their own hometown. I'm from Springer, and I thought she was from Springer. And you're going to have people in Santa Fe thinking she's from there. But as I started doing, and, you know, all over the state, and as I started doing my research, I realized that, you know, people in Mexico think she's from there, people in Colombia, in L.A., you know, so it's a really interesting phenomena that we have. And she's very much like a living legend among the community.
Is this, I always thought it was Mexican and New Mexican. Does this legend extend into South America?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, as I did my research, my research points to the legend originating in Mexico at the time of the conquistadores. And then from there, it spread by word of mouth throughout the Americas. So most of the countries across South America as well have a version of La Llorona. The countries that don't tend to be countries that had very late European immigration, and they wiped out the natives. So, of course, the stories were lost as well. So countries like Argentina, Uruguay, or Chile tend not to have, you know, much knowledge of the legend. But otherwise, she's really all over.
What part of the... How do I say that? What part of the soul do you think this legend speaks to? I mean, what's it really about on a mythological level?
Wow, that's a very interesting question. And before I answer that, I just want to say, though, this legend really is more of a universal legend, because La Llorona she's essentially a universal female archetype, because as I continued my research, I expanded outside of the Latino culture and found that there are similar legends in virtually, you know, every culture around the world that you can imagine, you know, from India to China to Europe, just all over Africa. So it is more of a universal female, you know, universal legend. And from one perspective, I think it really does talk to the power of women as a life giver and even a life taker. And this is something that Jungian psychologists study La Llorona for, as a source of life and a taker of life. And they relate it to water, because water is the source of all life. And without water, there would be no life. And La Llorona uses water as a tool to take the lives of her children. So it's really interesting. So I think it does speak to that on one level, the power of women. It also speaks to very, very primal fears, because nothing, or very, very few things can be more horrifying than having the person who gives birth to you, the person who you believe you can trust the most and will always protect you, having that person turn against you and actually kill you. So it's a very horrifying legend in that sense. So, you know, it's just loaded. It's loaded with so much that it speaks to. I could go on for hours, actually, on that, so I'll just stop with that.
Well, I mean, when you say that it's a legend about the power of women, it's not really a kind of power that we women probably want to aspire to, is it?
No, not at all. Not at all. But in the sense of being the life giver, you know, that speaks to our power in a very positive sense, that we give birth. In terms of taking life, you know, I think there's it's much more, yeah, that is something that we don't want to aspire to at all. I'd agree with that.
So you studied engineering, and you studied business, and you worked as a venture capitalist. How did you decide to go into filmmaking?
Well, I actually, speaking of fears that I mentioned before, it was all about this fear that I have of waking up when I'm 90 years old and looking back and saying, I wish I would have. So I'd always had this story of La Llorona in my mind, no matter, you know, where I was living. I was fortunate enough to be able to live in many countries around the world, and this legend just always stuck with me. And I just had this craving to make a story, a film about her. And I just got to the point where I realized, you know, that life is really short and precious, and if we don't do the things that are important to us, you know, then why even bother? Why are we here if we're not doing the things that are, you know, following our dreams? And that was a dream I had of making this movie. So I quit my job and started working on this and figuring out, well, how do I make a movie? What do I do? And that was the beginning of a very long journey, actually.
Well, what did you do? I mean, this, I suppose, for many people who are aspiring independent filmmakers and who themselves have always dreamed of making a film, I mean, what did you do? What was the process like? What was the first thing you did once you quit your job?
Well, I mean, the first thing I needed to do is write the script, and I needed to understand La Llorona before I could really write a script. So that process was actually very long because I had no idea how complex she was. Once again, I just thought it was a legend from Springer, New Mexico, and if I just speak with a few people there, I'd know all about her, and I'd be able to immediately write the script from that. But it turned out to be 5 years of research on her throughout the Americas that I conducted. Now, I was still working at my job while I was doing that.
How did you do that research? I mean, what did you actually do?
Well, I contacted, you know, I started actually in New Mexico. There's a very dear family friend and a historian that I started with called Anselmo Arellano, who has, he lives in Las Vegas, and he connected me with a lot of research he had done. He connected me with people in New Mexico. So I started my research in New Mexico, and then it just spread out just from the network there. It just started spreading out, first across the Southwest primarily, and then contacts would lead me to people in Mexico and other places in South America. So it was through the network of people that all started with Anselmo, essentially. And then I did a lot of research online, just digging up any materials I could find. I also started interviewing people who believe they've seen or heard her, and that was really fascinating. So I have those all on videotape. Started collecting stories. I put up a website with the information as I was collecting it, and people started coming to me. I started getting almost immediately thousands and thousands of visitors every month, and that's with no marketing effort whatsoever, and I still get a tremendous amount of traffic. People still write to me with their stories. I also started collecting poems and paintings that have been dedicated to her. You know, worked with some Jungian psychologists who study her as a universal female archetype. So it's just, you know, was a network that just spread like wildfire throughout the U.S. and Latin America. So that was a long process, as I said, 5 years. And then once I felt like I understood her enough to write a story about her, then that's when the real sort of, you know, the script writing started. And that was a struggle as well, because I'd never written a script. And I really believe at this point that script writing is perhaps the most difficult form of writing that you can imagine, because there's very much a structure and and to it that, you know, you really need to capture the audience immediately. You have to take them for a ride for a while in a certain direction, and, you know, there are different summits that you have to hit, and it's very difficult to keep an audience engaged with a story, and so script writing is quite difficult. So that took me a while to figure that out.
You had a co-writer, didn't you?
Yeah, she came in at a later stage. I actually wrote several versions, and then Monique Salazar, she's from Albuquerque, and then later on, I was also very eager to collaborate on this with someone who would have some familiarity with the legend as well, and Monique being from New Mexico, I thought it was a great opportunity to work with her. So we joined forces to basically put the final script together, and, you know, which was a great experience working with her. And then once the script was together, it was all the process of pulling together the financing, and which is a whole other can of worms.
How did you do that? I mean, that's not easy.
You know, it was interesting. No, it isn't. I learned a lot in that process, because being a venture capitalist, when I was working in that world, when you're pitching a deal and looking for financing or giving out financing, it's all about the money. It's all about what's the return, what's the opportunity. It's a very business approach. And I took a very business approach to raising the financing for the film, in terms of putting together the business plan and then pitching it as a business opportunity. And I realized soon that that was not the way, that was not an effective way to pitch money for a script, because the bottom line is, films are so risky, chances are investors are not going to make their money back. So, you know, that's just the reality. So, of course, when I was speaking to people in this manner, you know, I was being very open. This is what's going on, and these are the risks, and et cetera, et cetera. And it just wasn't working. And then I realized, but wait a minute, people don't get involved generally in financing films because they see it as a business opportunity, because there are far better ways for them to use their money than putting it into a film if they want to make money. And I realized it's not about that. It's about... It's about the excitement they get by participating and being in film, involved in a film. It's about their own emotional needs and being part of a passionate project, you know. And so once I realized that, and I switched gears and started presenting the film in that light, the money came in very quickly. It was a really interesting learning lesson for me.
So you screened this film in Santa Fe 2 years ago. What have you been doing with it, or what has the film done since then?
Yeah, when I screened it then, it was a 95% completed film. And so once I screened it, I actually went back for about 2 or 3 months and did some final work, mostly on the sound, in the sound area, and then completed it. And then at that point... started working on getting the distribution. Many filmmakers think that, you know, the biggest battle is completing the film, but actually the distribution is a much bigger mountain you have to climb, and very, very few independent films ever see the day of light in terms of distribution. So once I completed the film, I was focused on getting the film distributed, which took about 1 year to lock down all the distribution, both internationally and within the U.S. So then once that 1 year was done and I had the agreements in place, then it takes the distributors usually several months to set up, you know, the whole distribution outlets, being theatrical, you know, on TV, cable, DVD. So that's basically what's been going on over the past, past almost 2 years.
And what kind of responses have you gotten from people both familiar and unfamiliar with La Llorona legend?
Well, the film just opened last weekend theatrically. It has a limited theatrical run. So far, my understanding is, because, you know, it's my distributor handling everything right now, is that the responses have been very good. They've held over the film in all four states that they opened in, which is a good sign, because, you know, basically, if your film doesn't do well, they yank it right away, and it's been held over. So people must be must be interested in going to see it. So that's all good. I know that in the New Mexico screening, that people, there were some people there who were not familiar with La Llorona, and they were just fascinated, I'd say, just as much, if not even more, than people who have grown up with the legend. Perhaps more, because, you know, this was so new to them.
Although it's interesting, because we have a present-day La Llorona with Andrea Yates, who drowned her children in the bathtub about, what is it, in 2001.
I did a lot of research on infanticide when I was working on putting the script together, because that is a very, you know, there are obvious links to it. And I make reference to both her and Susan Smith within the film.
Right.
So, yeah, we do have. And, you know, one thing that really surprised me when I was doing my research is how common it is for women to kill their own children. It's really frightening, and it's something that society, you know, isn't really, our society isn't addressing very effectively, so it seems. So it was a really interesting interesting process to study all that.
The film is called The Cry. It opens on Friday, May 2nd, that's tomorrow, at the Santa Fe Film Center on St. Michael's Drive. And Bernadine Santisteban, are you going to be coming back to New Mexico at any point?
Oh, well, I go there all the time. My family's still there.
So. Oh, okay.
So yes, absolutely. And I'm working on a TV pilot, actually, that I was hired to write and direct. And I'm hoping to convince the producers to shoot that in New Mexico, so we shall see.
What's that about?
It also is tied in to La Llorona, but there's another spin to it. It's essentially I'm creating a world where we're in a planet-wide water crisis, and if something is not done immediately, there will be no life on planet Earth within 50 years. So the tie-in to La Llorona is she gets her power from water. So she's this major force within the whole context of the TV series. But of course, she doesn't want the water to go away because that's where she gets her life.
Right.
So anyway, it's sort of like a combination, supernatural sci-fi, I guess you could call it. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Bernadine Santisteban is the director, producer, and co-writer of the film The Cry, which opens tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Film Center on St. Michael's Drive in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the film Chicago 10. Please stay tuned to KSFR 101.1 FM. I'd like now to welcome Brett Morgan. He is the writer and director of the film Chicago 10, which opens here in Santa Fe at the Center for Contemporary Arts this Friday, the 2nd of May. The film was the winner of the Chicago Film Festival's Best Documentary Award in 2007. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, set up August in 1968 in Chicago for us. What was happening in national politics and in the war protest movement that led to the confrontation at the Democratic National Convention that year?
Oh, gosh, loaded question. There is a lot of stuff going on. I mean, essentially, you know, one of the things about the Chicago demonstrations were there were a myriad of issues that people were coming to Chicago to protest. The candidates, the war, the women's movement, a whole host of issues. The thing that we focused on in the film was the anti-war movement and the protest surrounding the outside the Democratic Convention. Chicago 10 isn't so much a film about the politics of the election that year. In fact, we only dip into the convention hall on one or two occasions. But really, it's a movie about, you know, a group of individuals who decided to do something at that convention to stage a protest and ultimately created one of the greatest pieces of political theater I think ever mounted in U.S. soil, which is why I think the subject sort of lends itself so easily to a film. I mean, it's the 1960s were filled with all sorts of spectacles, and the spectacle outside the Democratic Convention in 68 truly was one of the of a decade of great spectacles was probably the one of the watershed moments.
I mean, it's an amazing thing to witness in the film, which, and we'll get into the very interesting way that you made the film in just a few minutes, but this relationship between the activists, the peace demonstrators who were there for what they called a celebration of life, and then this incredibly heavily armed police and essentially military force, you know, the 25,000 police and National Guard, helicopters with machine gun, there's a shot of a tank, and even the newscaster Walter Cronkite said, this is a police state. Why was the government response so intense?
You know, I think it was a culture of fear, and I think that, I mean, there are a couple things. One of the subtexts for me about in the film is dealing with sort of patriarchal politics, and the sense that Mayor Daley, and to a lesser extent Johnson, and certainly Judge Hoffman, who presided over the conspiracy trial, I think they all were completely threatened by anyone who didn't look like them and who didn't act like them. And so, you know, Jerry Rubin had predicted that all the yippies had to do was show up in Chicago and Daley would go berserk and call in the National Guard, and that's exactly what happened. Throughout the film, you hear comments from both members of Daley's administration and people on the street who will say things like, well, why don't you just cut your hair, you know, and then everything will be fine. And it was amazing how threatened people were by the physicality of the protesters and the. So I think Daley and Judge Hoffman both felt that these people represented a disease in this country, and they needed to cut the head off the snake before it polluted the rest of the nation.
Now, for those who were born perhaps after 1968, who were the Yippies?
Well, the Yippies were founded by Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Paul Krasner, Ed Sanders, Bob Faust, and a bunch of other folk here on the Lower East Side in New York City. And essentially, around December of 1967, there was a strong anti-war movement in America. People, organizations like SDS and the mobilization against the war in Vietnam being the sort of two main proponents. But the anti-war movement was a bit sober. And so you have this anti-war movement going on, and then you have this cultural revolution going on with the hippies. And the yippie idea was to fuse the anti-war movement with the hippies, sort of unite everyone and create this new sort of movement, which was yippie. The idea of yippie was always to bring a sense of fun and theater into the anti-war movement, to make it something that you can, as they said, the festival of life, a celebration of basically sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and politics. And so it's interesting because I experienced the events of Chicago prenatally. I was in my mom's womb, and I was born October of 68. And I always had this, growing up, I always just thought, oh, all hippies were radicalized, and they were all political from the beginning. And while growing your hair long was a political statement in 1967, there were really two sort of distinct movements. And I think what the yippies did, as I said, that I found so sort of inspiring today was really bring the sense of theater and excitement to that movement. Some people dismissed them at the time as clowns or pranksters or what have you, but behind the silliness and the comedy was a really powerful message. And, Abby Hoffman used to say, and I think this is he says in the film, politics isn't who you vote for, it's how you live your life. And I think the yippies while they're still around today, and 68 was their birth, and they really made a strong statement in 72, I think that there's a lot of lessons we could take from them. And I certainly think when I was trying to get financing for the film, I would often tell my potential investors that in many ways, Michael Moore has inherited the mantle of the yippies in the sense that he uses comedy and entertainment to get people engaged in really serious political ideals. And Abbie Hoffman is kind of the muse of my film. I think the film is very sort of yippie-centric. And once again, this idea of theater really lends itself to film. And I think people who know Abbie or knew of Abbie at the time will have a whole new appreciation for him when they see him in this film. I mean, the man was a master of getting his message out there and creating this sort of excitement. And he really kind of was like Lenny Bruce. He was so unbelievably funny and engaging and charming. And I think for those who have never come across Abbie, they'll be really excited to see, they sort of ask themselves the question I think a lot of us ask when we're making the film is, where are these guys today? Not meaning where's Abbie, but where's the next generation of Abbies?
That's a great point, because I mean the Michael Moore is really a great comparison to Abbie Hoffman. But one of the differences that I really thought about when I was thinking about, you know, today's anti-war culture, protest culture, and 1968, is that audacious, hilarious, totally disrespectful spectacle that Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin were doing in the courtroom is something you can barely imagine that today.
I mean, there's a sense when you're watching the film, I think particularly for people under 40 when they see the film, that they cannot, not only, they cannot believe this happened. They can't believe that the United States government would bring tanks, you know, and cars with barbed wire and drive them directly into, you know, crowds of innocent bystanders. So there's that level of shock. But I think there's also a sort of, you're left with the feeling of, where are these guys? Why haven't we, our generation, produced more sort of leaders, if you will? And I think that they're out there. They're just probably not getting the same sort of coverage from the media that Abbie got. Abbie was a master of the soundbite. He was really the you know, some people have said to me, and I think there's some truth to this, that he almost created the modern day soundbite. There's a great story. You know, and people may know of Abbie from his little prank at the New York Stock Exchange when he threw a bunch of dollar bills onto the floor of the stock exchange in 67 and basically shut the place down as all the stockbrokers working on million-dollar transactions went running to get grabbed dollar bills. But Len Weinglass, one of the defense attorneys, told me this story one day, which I think is really poignant, which is they were in the courtroom and there was some really damning testimony from the prosecution. And Len turned over to Abbie and said, "Oh, we're going to get killed tonight in the news." And Abbie said, "Hey, Len, you want me to make it go away?" And Len said, "Yeah, what are you going to do?" Jill, thank you. And Len said, "Abbie, what are you going to do?" And Abbie said, "Watch this, Len." And Abbie got up and started doing handstands in the courtroom. And the lead story on that news that night was that the damning testimony was in the courtroom today in the Chicago conspiracy case, Abbie Hoffman was doing handstands.
That's amazing.
So he really knew how to manipulate the media and engage them in a way that on the surface might seem rather silly, but there was always like a political angle behind it. I mean, even the moment in the film or in the trial that we document where Abbie and Jerry showed up in the courtroom in judge's robes. On the surface level, it's just, you know, pure sort of slapstick comedy a la the Marx Brothers or the Three Stooges. On a deeper level, they are clearly challenging the authority of the court and basically suggesting that, you know, Judge Hoffman cannot, you know, sort of cannot own them, and that it was kind of an amazing little moment.
We're talking to Brett Morgan. The film is called Chicago 10. It opens at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. I mean, one of the people in the film said, "Our role in the court is to destroy its authority, and then the next generation will come along and destroy its power." And watching it 40 years later, that certainly hasn't happened.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's where they were a bit idealistic. I mean, I think they really thought that when they were convicted that there was going to be a mass uprising in this country, and there were protests and riots. But I think that the trial went on for so long that by the time it concluded, the country was at a slightly different place and had different agendas. And for a lot of these guys, that was kind of like they never were able to get back on the national stage the way they were at the beginning of the trial.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what the trial was for. The trial was of the what's called the Chicago 7 or Chicago 8, depending on whether you count Black Panther leader Bobby Seale. First of all, why is your film called Chicago 10?
Well, you know, it's funny. For years, I called it, as I was making the film, C7. And then at a certain point, I said, I can't call this film Chicago 7 because there's 8 defendants. You know, the reason it became known as the Chicago 7 in popular folklore was there were 8 defendants. So it was known in the news at the time as the case of the Chicago 8. Bobby Seale was severed from the case 2 months in, and it then became known as the Chicago 7. But to not include Bobby Seale in the title, I thought would be a bit prejudicial. He's in the film from beginning to end. So we were going to call it Chicago 8. And then, you know, as I was finishing the film, I sort of felt that, you know, the attorneys in the film get as much screen time as the defendants. And the two attorneys, Len Weinglass and Bill Kunstler, received 7 years of contempt between them. And so, in fact, Kunstler received 4.5 years of contempt charges from the judge, which was more than any of the defendants. So in many ways, the lawyers sort of became one with the defendants, and I thought that since the movie is ultimately about appropriation and taking these images of the 60s and telling a story that would resonate today, that we would just sort of appropriate the title and rebrand it the Chicago 10.
There's a lot of interesting things about the trial, including the charges themselves, the conspiracy, the intent to incite riots, and the defendants talk about their crime being carrying ideas across state lines. What were they actually prosecuted for?
Now, see, it's funny because you're in Santa Fe and I'm in New York. Whenever I do a telephone call across state lines, I always feel like I need to be really careful. you know, it was a completely bogus charge. In fact, nobody had ever been tried for that under that law, and nobody has been tried since under that. The Anti-Riot Act of 1968 was something that came as a result of the race riots following Dr. King's assassination. And ironically, it was attached to the Civil Rights Bill of that year. So the great irony of this case is here you have all of these guys who spent the early part of the 60s protesting civil rights out of Mississippi now being charged for a civil rights violation. And basically what it said was if you cross state lines with the idea to engage in a riot, not that you're going to start a riot, not that you're going to really tell any more than 2 people about it, but if you just go with the intent that you can be arrested. It's funny, when I went to college, I went to college in Amherst, Massachusetts. I went to a school called Hampshire College. And there was actually a law at Smith College, which was an all-girls school down the street from us, that if you went to the campus with the intent to hook up, it was a violation. You could be thrown off campus. So that
necessitates a thought police.
Exactly. No, it's incredible. And so as I said, it's a completely bogus charge. One of the other great ironies of this is the protesters never rioted the entire time they were there. It was the cops who rioted, and that's not a subjective interpretation. The government, in the government's report on the events of Chicago, they referred to the riots as quote-unquote police riots. So these were riots instigated by the Chicago Police Department. And yet what happened was Ramsey Clark, who was the attorney general in 1968, was absolutely, completely sympathetic with the protesters. He had flown down to Chicago to meet with Daley and his staff to try to urge them to work out some sort of compromise. And Daley just completely ignored the attorney general. When Nixon was elected in November of that year, one of the first things he did was have John Mitchell, as Attorney General, file charges against the leaders of the anti-war movement. And this was ultimately an attempt to just take these guys out of the picture and off the streets. You know, what he did was he took sort of the main sort of the guys who had the most public faces in the movement, so Tom Hayden, Dave Dellinger, Rennie Davis, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and then, you know, as Jerry refers to in the film, he threw Bobby Seale in, you know, because, you know, the government believes in integration, so you have to have a black man in there, so what better than the national chairman of the Black Panther Party? Bobby Seale, as Jerry says, was only in Chicago for a half a day to make one speech in Lincoln Park. He was a last-minute replacement speaker for Stokely Carmichael and had never met the defendants before, never met them in Chicago, flew in, made a speech, and left. And yet he gets indicted for crossing state lines with the intent to start a riot. And furthermore, as the audience will experience in the film, when he gets put on trial, Bobby's lawyer, Charles Gary, was having gallbladder surgery in Oakland, and so Bobby asked to defend himself. The judge refused to allow Bobby to defend himself, so Bobby, on advice of Charles Gary, every time his name was mentioned in the courtroom, Bobby would stand up and say, "Your Honor, I object. I have the right to defend myself." And it got to the point where finally Judge Hoffman had Bobby bound and gagged and chained to his chair. So here you have, in a civil rights case, 1969, the leader of the Black Panther Party chained, bound, and gagged to a chair, basically being silenced because he wants to exercise his constitutional rights to defend himself. It's like I said, I think that, it's hard for us, despite the fact, well, maybe it's not so hard now. I mean, we clearly are living with a current president who's lied and deceived us and has ignored the will of the people at every turn. So maybe it's not so surprising that the government would do this. But I think if you put it in the context of 1968, you know, America was still a rather innocent nation. I think that, you know, Norman Mailer said that the death of innocence in America began with Kennedy's assassination and ended on August 29th in front of the Conrad Hilton in Chicago in 1968, where the police brutally attacked innocent bystanders. I think that a lot of Americans going into the Democratic Convention '68 really believed, had a great deal of trust and faith in the government.
Well, let's talk about white Americans anyway.
Yeah, thank you very much for pointing that out. When we talk about Chicago's political theater, one of the things that the Yippies wanted to do was expose the militancy of this government. And to that end, they were unbelievably successful. For the first time, and I'm very glad you made the distinction between white Americans and Native Americans and African Americans, because Chicago really was a battle between white middle class kids, when I say kids, college age, 20-year-olds, and the government. And I think while people had become somewhat used to, as sick as that sounds, at that point of seeing images of African Americans being attacked down in Alabama and in the South, people really hadn't seen the government attacking white middle class kids with the vitriolic sort of hatred that they expressed in Chicago. And so I think in many ways you started to have to rethink who was running our country and what really, who were they serving?
We're talking to Brett Morgan. The film is called Chicago 10. It opens at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe tomorrow. So in the film, you worked with court transcripts as well as archival audio footage, and you animated them to provide courtroom drama because, of course, there are no cameras in the courtroom at that time. It was such a creative way. Tell us about how you chose to do that.
Well, there was no, as you said, there was no cameras in the courtroom. So I could either do a sort of talking head account of what happened, or find some other ways to visualize. And one of my goals with Chicago 10 was to make a movie that captured the experience of Chicago in a very visceral and engaging way. So there's no narrator. There's no talking head interviews. This isn't a movie about people in their 70s looking back on their lives. It's a movie in which you can experience these events as they unfolded. And to that extent, I needed some sort of device for the trial. Now, I could have either done it with actors in live-action reenactments, but I felt that given the great weight of archival material in the film, the audience would constantly be comparing the archival elements to the actors depicting them. And be like, oh, that guy is Vincent D'Onofrio. He doesn't look like Abbie Hoffman. And it would be really jarring and distracting. The other thing was, the trial was a circus. And I'd come across a quote from Jerry Rubin in which he said he called the trial a Saturday morning cartoon show. And I said, what a great way to approach this. It's very much in the Yippie tradition. Let's present history as a cartoon show. It'll make it more engaging and more fun to watch. And, you know, at the end of the day, what I've tried to do with all my movies is entertain people. I mean, that's, you know, I think we have this perception of documentaries as being, which has been changing over the last 10 years for sure. But, you know, there is this tradition of documentaries being sort of like cough medicine. You know, it's good for you, but it doesn't go down easily. And particularly, you know, there's been a awful lot of movies about the war or about the war movement that have come out in the last 9 months that are quite sobering and really aren't that fun to engage in. With Chicago 10, which was, you know, conceived, it seems like an eternity ago, 6 years ago in 2002, from the get-go, we said, let's make a movie that's in the spirit of Yippie, that's fun, exciting, engaging, and has this sort of, you know, political undercurrent to it. You know, really, the animation sort of, I think, really lent itself to sort of that kind of approach.
And especially since it's mixed with visual, you know, film footage of the time. And I have to say, I also really appreciated that you didn't just use 60s music. You used music, a soundtrack that's, you know, current to our day as well. So it doesn't have quite that dated 60s aesthetic that some of those documentaries have.
Exactly. I think that you know, some of the protest music of the 1960s, you know, you hear it now in, like, you know, Volkswagen commercials. And once that protest music has been appropriated by Madison Avenue, it no longer has the same punch or sting that it did at the time. And I sort of felt that I didn't want to make a movie that was completely, that would alienate people under 40. I thought that they should have music that resonated with their lives, and that by taking, you know, contemporary tracks and using images from 40 years ago, you suddenly can bring the past into the present, and stuff that happened, you know, before a lot of my audience's lifetime suddenly feels like something that might have happened last week. Last month.
Well, I have to say, I watched it with a friend of mine who was born in the 80s who loved it, and it totally resonated. So I think there's probably many examples of the film being successful in that way. One thing I really wanted to talk to you about was when we talk about Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman and making their own trial a circus, on the one hand, it really energized their supporters, and on the other hand, it alienated a lot of other people in the rest of the country in a way that was exploited for probably a full generation at least afterwards. You know, was that kind of behavior divisive? I mean, that's something I've thought about a lot.
I'll tell you, Jerry Rubin was on the Phil Donahue show right after the trial, and it was right at the beginning of Donahue's career. And Phil said, you know, Jerry, don't you realize that you are alienating, you know, people think you're obnoxious, you know, your tactics are alienating more people than they're inspiring. And Jerry said, oh, okay, Phil, what do you want me to do? Write a letter to the president, dear Mr. Nixon, can you please get out of Vietnam? He goes, no, I'm not going to do that. This isn't the time to be quiet. This isn't the time to be polite. You know, I am angry, and I'm going to voice that. And I think that it's true that they did tend to alienate people. Listen, I mean, many people can look at the year 68 and say that what the protesters did at the 68 convention was essentially hand the election over to Nixon by showing, you know, how the Democrats couldn't, you know, control, the, you know, Democrats couldn't even control their own people how are they going to control the nation? In fact, Nixon showed up in Chicago 3 days after the convention and gave a huge speech about law and order in front of 500,000 people at the Conrad Hilton. So clearly, history will record that they gave the election to Nixon. If you ask the yippies, they would have told you that there's no difference in their mind between Nixon and Johnson, that they're all part of the machine, and that's why they wanted to elect a pig as president in 1968. Pegasus. So, yeah, there's definitely truth that they alienated people, but I don't know if there was a way. I mean, David Dellinger is got to be the least, you know, if there's one guy who is completely unthreatening to anyone who crosses his path, it would be Dave Dellinger. There was nothing yet. Dellinger, I don't think, engaged the youth the way that Abby and Jerry did. You know, at that time, these guys were rock stars. Jerry and Abby would go speak at college campuses and sell out arenas with 27,000 people in like 2 hours. You know, so they were speaking to the people that they wanted to reach. And I think they sort of felt, you know, that's who they were, their constituents were, that's who they were going to engage, and to heck with the rest of them.
We're talking to Brett Morgan. The film is called Chicago 10. I have to say, I'm hoping to see the film at least once or twice more, because it really makes one reflect on the nature of power and the nature of political change, because here you are watching this, and, you know, for all the effort to put power in the hands of the people and undo the culture of militarism, it seems like we're at the same point now that we are then. There's the same critiques of the mass media, of imperialism, of race, of militarism, war crimes, and so on. So what did that era do? I mean, I don't know, who can answer this, but what are the legacies, what are the positive legacies of that time and of that convention?
Well, like I said, I think, we're certainly going to be looking at that convention quite a bit, I think, going into this year's Democratic convention. I mean, it's a bit uncanny how the potential for similar actions and activities. I think that for me, it came down to this. The protests, the yippie protests in Chicago, started with three guys sitting in a loft in New York City, smoking pot, watching TV, and going, hey, let's do something in Chicago this year. And there is something completely inspiring about that, that you don't have to have a degree in protest to get out there and do something. In fact, I don't think with the film I'm advocating street protests at all. I think where the message of the film is, hey, no one could tell you what to do. You need to just sort of decide for your own what feels best. And for me, at least, having seen the movie or made a movie like Chicago 10, what I take from that is this sense of that sense that politics is how you live your life, not who you support, and this sense of fun to bring to the anti-war movement. I was the movie was invited to be the opening night film at the Sundance Film Festival in 2007, and while I was there, I was asked to speak at a anti-war rally. And I showed up on Main Street in Park City, and there were like 40 people with, you know, signs saying, stop the war, and everyone was going, stop the war. And I turned to the organizer and I said, man, it's you know, 10 degrees here, it's freezing, you know, this is kind of burnt. Next time you do this, let's get a kegger and a rock band or something and turn it into a party. And I think that sort of, if people could engage on that level, we may have a lot more you know, people getting involved. So it's not such, it doesn't have to be, protest doesn't, even though what we are protesting is sober, I think people coming together to share beliefs can be celebratory, and that we need to bring some of that fun and excitement into the movement.
So do you have any sense of whether your film is encouraging or discouraging activists from engaging in protest, for example, at the next convention, the Democratic convention?
I think for those who see the film, it has a really positive effect. I'm hoping that the organizers in Minneapolis and Denver really take notice of the film and understand that as Americans, we all have a constitutional right to protest, and that when a city brings in a national convention, they are whether they like it or not, inviting protesters and demonstrators to come to that city. And they have an obligation to provide them with a safe and vital place to stage their demonstrations. Now, if protesters want to storm the convention floor, you know, there's clearly safety issues there, and that can't happen. But there is absolutely no reason they cannot be given a place to speak right outside the convention hall. And I think that if the, you know, the people running the convention this year don't take notice of that, they will have blood on their hands.
Brett Morgan is the Oscar-nominated writer and director of the film Chicago 10, which opens here in Santa Fe at the Center for Contemporary Arts this Friday, the 2nd of May, and it's screening on, Friday, Saturday at 8:15, and also on Saturday and Sunday at noon. Check the paper for film times. The film Chicago 10 was the winner of the Chicago Film Festival's Best Documentary Award in 2007. It opened at Sundance. Brett Morgan, fabulous film. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. One last thing, too. I just want to say I started my film career. The first festival I ever went to was the Taos Film Festival in 1996, and I had shown three or four films there where I met Jason Silverman. So I have a really fond memory of being in that area, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's great, and we hope to see you in Santa Fe one of these days.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team under the direction of the marvelous Bill Dupuy. And after that, Good Morning Jazz will feature an interview with Howard Rumsey. You know, I said this yesterday, but it wasn't yesterday. It was today. Anyway, Howard Rumsey, the musical director of the world's great jazz clubs, one of the world's great jazz clubs, the Lighthouse in Hermosa Beach in California, and a tribute to the late Jimmy Giuffre, who passed away on Saturday. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott and much, much more. Hasta la vista. Ciao.